Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, November the 13th. I believe we owe the people of Iraq a collective apology. I say this as a former employee of the United Nations Oil for Food Program, the $64 billion operation that was set up to help Iraqis survive economic sanctions under Saddam Hussein, and is now the subject of a spiraling controversy. So wrote our guest in 2005 when the Oil for Food scandal was breaking, and he helped to break it. We will talk about how he got involved in all this and the lessons we can learn from this scandal this hour. Our guest is Michael Soussaw. He is the former United Nations Program Coordinator for the United Nations Oil for Food Program. And he is the author of a book about his experience at that time. The book is Backstabbing for Beginners, My Crash Course in International Diplomacy. And Michael Soussaw is also currently teaching international affairs and the Iraq conflict at New York University Center for Global Affairs. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
You know, I have to confess, I thought a book on this topic was going to be dull, but I was wrong. It was laugh out loud funny in parts, and I mean, that sounds odd saying that I was laughing at such a serious topic, but it really must have been it wasn't funny for you at the time, though, was it?
No, but let's say that this book was also my therapy, and one way to deal with tragic circumstances is really to look at the funny sides, at the absurd sides of certain aspects of the situation.
Yeah. Well, let's first of all remind us, what was the Oil for Food program?
Well, it was set up as a humanitarian program that was meant to alleviate the suffering of the Iraqi people during the time of the sanctions. As you remember, in 1991, we forced Saddam out of Kuwait, but in the process, we also bombed Iraq back to the pre-industrial age, according to a UN report, and left them with Saddam in power and with sanctions. So that combination was extremely devastating to Iraqi society. And so we decided eventually to let Iraq, we, meaning the United Nations, to let Iraq sell oil on the condition that all the proceeds be used exclusively for humanitarian needs under UN supervision. And so that was the premise under which we started our work. And I joined in 1997 when the program was basically getting up and running.
Yeah, and before that you were working for Jack Abramoff.
Well, that was a bit of a strange strange circumstance. I was planning to go to law school, and I had applied to a law firm in Washington, D.C. to prepare my resume for law school. And I ended up working in a firm that was otherwise Democratic in majority, in a group directed by Jack Abramoff, who ended up, as we learned later, being the subject of a pretty scathing scandal as well.
Yeah, that's right. And how did you manage to get such a prominent position with this UN program? At you were only 24?
Yes, sheer luck. You know, when the UN starts new operations, they basically need people on a very short-term basis. They need to employ very rapidly. And this was one of those situations where I basically had a friend who just got the job and turned it down in favor of a job at the Clinton administration. And as a result, when I called, they needed someone really fast. And the guy that held the position before me had gone to Brown University as well. And so I think that probably smoothed things a bit.
Well, no disrespect intended, but indicative? Was that problem number one, that they would just hire someone like you, wet behind the ears and just like that?
Well, when I came in to the interview, I asked them whether they had been thinking about their relationship with Congress. There was some significant opposition from the very start to this program in Congress. And so despite a year of work that I basically was not very happy with because dealing with people like Jack Abramoff and so on, I still had learned a lot about public policy and the legislative process and dealing with the media. And so it turned out that I wasn't, in fact, unqualified for the job. I was just young. You know, that is obviously...
Okay, so tell...
You know, they need people who can speak English, who can write, and things like that. So at the end of the day, it worked out.
Tell us what you were expected to do in this position.
Well, that wasn't very clear from the beginning. But, you know, when they set up these operations, they often appoint coordinators or so-called focal points who are young and who don't have the authority to necessarily do the job, which is basically to get the trains to run on time, to get the reports submitted on time to the Security Council, and so on and so forth. We had 9 UN agencies working in Iraq under the program, and a lot of them would basically be fighting with each other over what to write in the reports to the Security Council. And so somebody had to go around and collect all the data and try to make grammatical sentences out of the reports we were getting from the field.
And you were dubbed the kid.
Well, we all had nicknames. Mm-hmm. You see. The head of the operation was an undersecretary general, a heavyweight, both his physical description and a UN veteran of many programs called Benon Sivan, and he would get the nickname of Pasha. So little by little, everybody sort of got a nickname, and it formed a bit of a strange community as we built from scratch this office into the largest humanitarian operation in UN history.
The part of my chuckles going through your book was how difficult a time you had in understanding the boss. Talk about that.
Yeah, he was an Armenian from Cyprus who had a bit of a strange accent, but I don't think his accent was the problem. I think he just pronounced about a third of the words necessary to make an average sentence. So I found myself, as you said, at the age of 24, flying into Iraq at a time of crisis with a man I could hardly understand, and I was supposed to take this guy's notes for the next 2 weeks, so I was pretty stressed.
And wait, his nickname was it Pasha?
Pasha, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a sheikh or...
Yeah, and who was he really?
Benon Sivan was his name.
Yeah, and who was Spooky?
Spooky was a character I refer to in my book as Trevor Phillips, I believe. I had to change names, you know. So I'd rather not. You know, people that are not already in the public domain and still work there need to be protected a bit. Yeah.
Well, anyway, this was your dream job, and what it turns out to be a nightmare.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, when I heard the offer that we were going to work for one of the largest humanitarian operations ever put together by the United Nations, to me, it sounded like a dream job. I could finally be a do-gooder, a humanitarian, and, I didn't know that I was stepping into what would turn into the largest scandal in UN history, because eventually Saddam Hussein obviously defrauded the program and paid off hundreds of diplomats around the world, received kickbacks from about 2,300 international corporations, and eventually even our big boss, Pasha, was found guilty of corruption as well.
Yeah, so how did you begin to be aware of that there was corruption involved here?
I guess the first time I became aware of the phenomenon was when we were in Iraq and we were supposed to drive to the Kurdish north, and we were informed that there was no fuel to be had in the country. And so I said, wait a minute, you know, this is the world's second largest oil reserves, and there's no fuel here. How can that be? And It turned out when we arrived on the Turkish border that basically Saddam Hussein was smuggling the fuel out to Turkey, selling it in violation of the sanctions for personal profit. And so we just saw these trucks there. It was, you know, it was not a secret. And I was wondering whether we were going to report this, you know, to the Security Council. And it turned out that Pasha didn't think it was a good idea. And so little by little, these kinds of events would accumulate, and I would understand that the scale of the corruption was, in fact, enormous. But it would take me years, and really until 2004, before I realized that Pasha himself had been part of the scam.
Yeah, you know, and this is, so Saddam Hussein was pocketing this money, but he was also bribing other people. And this did play a role in support for the, or lack of support with the war in Iraq?
Well, it's ironic, you know, it played a role in both ways. In one sense, it played a role because the U.S. administration, the Bush administration, was becoming worried that Saddam Hussein was, in fact, reestablishing his power thanks to all this money that he was skimming from the Oil for Food program. So in one sense, it made them more likely to take action against his regime. On the other hand, since, you know, Russian companies and French companies were among the largest purchaser of Iraqi oil, in the case of Russia, it's quite clear that every party in the Russian Duma, the Russian parliament, got profited illegally from this operation in connivance with Saddam Hussein in a system that was basically coordinated by the Putin government itself.
Not so clear with France?
There were high-level officials in France who profited from this arrangement as well, but it was not coordinated by the government itself as it was in Russia, mm-hmm. and it didn't go to finance every single party in the French parliament as it did in Russia. So I think the scales are quite different and can hardly be compared. But obviously France was worried about what would be found when after the invasion. That was, I think, quite obvious as well. Yeah.
So when did you blow the whistle?
Well, I actually did something slightly different from blowing the whistle. I called for an independent investigation in an article in the Wall Street Journal in January 2004, I believe. So basically, after they had invaded Iraq, they found a list of Saddam's bribe recipients in the Iraqi oil ministry. And it was an Iraqi newspaper that published this as a scoop for the first time. And once this was out, I had basically been advising the UN to undertake an investigation of the fraud that had been going on for some time. But they would not listen to me. And so when that came out, I had to decide either I'm part of a cover-up or I'm part of the solution. And I decided that the best thing for me to do was to follow my conscience and call for an independent investigation. So a couple of weeks after that op-ed, Kofi Annan basically decided to appoint Paul Volcker to head a 60-member-strong investigation that cost $30 million and was probably the first real exercise in accountability on the world stage.
Yeah. And the results of that investigation, what happened to the wrongdoers?
Well, it depends where they live, you see. Mm-hmm. Those who live in accountable democracies in the United States or in Western Europe, many of them have been brought to trial under fraud and corruption laws, domestic laws. But those who live in Syria, Lebanon, or even in Switzerland or in Russia have basically been left alone.
Yeah. So was this just, a freak case of corruption, or do you believe it's... It still exists.
Well, I think it's an indication of the wider problem we have in international trade. Everybody knows that when you deal in oil with a dictatorial regime, there is what they call the 10% rule, at a minimum 10%. But basically, the dictator of that country gets to decide who can sell, resell rather, the rights to buy oil. You see, it has a price, the right to buy oil. And that's what a lot of corrupt countries use in order to make their cronies or family members benefit from their country's sale of oil. This is why a lot of countries that should be rich remain poor, this kind of corruption. And on the other end, when they import goods, there is also ministers and their families and friends who take a cut. So this is really something that happens every day. The extraordinary thing that happened under the UN Oil Food Program was that for once, we got it all on the record.
Yeah. We are talking with Michael Sosson. He is former United Nations Program Coordinator for the United Nations Oil for Food Program. And he is the author of Backstabbing for Beginners, My Crash Course in International Diplomacy. He currently teaches international affairs and the Iraq conflict at New York University Center for Global Affairs. We welcome your questions for him, your reactions to this story at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We are talking about his adventures and misadventures in the world of international diplomacy and how we might learn from this oil for food program scandal, how that that might inform international challenges that we face today. We'll talk more about that after this. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, according to a new study, nearly half of U.S. physicians prescribe placebos to their patients. Ben and his guests will discuss medical treatment by placebo coming up after 5 o'clock. Tomorrow at this time, we will have Ed Garvey and Rick Berg with us. We will review the news of the week, as we always do every Friday after 8 o'clock. We will also have Ed and Rick on with me for a special appearance on Channel 3 in Madison at about 6:45 tomorrow morning. You can see Ed Garvey and Rick Berg, if you're in the Madison viewing area, on with Rob Starbuck and Joy Cardine on News 3 this morning, WISC-TV. So I hope you can watch us then and listen to us tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. We are talking with the author of Backstabbing for Beginners, My Crash Course in International Diplomacy, Michael Sosson. And Michael, who was the backstabber? Who was doing the backstabbing?
Oh, well, it works on many levels. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we collectively stabbed the Iraqi people in the back. Mm-hmm. We promised them in 1991 that we had absolutely no quarrel with the Iraqi people. The first President Bush said that. But in fact, the results of our actions were devastating for the civilian population of Iraq. And I think it came back to bite us in the rear, really, in 2003 when we realized that the big problem in Iraq was not so much Saddam's weapons, but his traumatized population, which had been living at a level of extreme poverty with kids less educated than their parents and very prone to be recruited by extremist organizations and so on. So that's, on the overall level of the story, really, the human dimension of the story, which I'm trying to basically retell here without so much of a focus on weapons of mass destruction, which characterized most of our approach in the media to the conflict for the past 10 years. Mm-hmm. But obviously, we're dealing with, office politics, and one of our reviewers basically came up with the notion that this was the BBC office The Office show meets Syriana. So, you know, on the one hand, we have petty office politics of the bureaucratic life at the United Nations. I sort of take the audience behind closed doors and let them experience what it's like to be inside this incredible organization, really, when you think about their mandate, which is to, preserve world peace. You can hardly preserve the peace between two people that sit in adjacent offices. So, that probably is the case of many organizations. But I really went into the subculture of the bureaucracies and the bureaucrats themselves, who ended up being quite colorful people. And, I think it's a situation that when you have scandals, you have finger-pointing, and it all ended up in a political bloodbath. So I think pretty much everybody felt both stabbed in the back and accused of being backstabbers in this situation.
Yeah. So do you have any confidence now in the UN Security Council?
Well, the Security Council is a strange animal, and I realized during this experience that they were basically operating like an oil cartel, like a drug cartel in a sense. The drug being oil in this case. But here's the problem, Joy. I think that accountability at a domestic level is ensured by a division of powers between the legislative branch and the judicial branch and the executive branch. In the case of the UN Security Council, we've got a bunch of states that were basically World War II victors who assigned to themselves the right to make war as long as they all agree. This body is accountable to no other body than itself. And it has the right to legislate, the right to oversee execution, and the right to adjudicate, basically, insofar as it sets up international courts. So we have all branches in one at the international level, and that is not a recipe for accountability.
So what lessons do you take from your experience and apply to the challenges that, say, the Barack Obama administration faces with the war in Iraq?
Mm-hmm. There's a range of lessons, I think, in this story. It really is an alternative tale of the last 13 years of the Iraq conflict, which took center stage for the best part of my generation's coming of age. So on a personal level, I think the lesson I draw from this is that it's important to... as the spy character Spooky advised me to do in the beginning, to be your own man and to basically listen to your own conscience, your own voice sometimes in making decisions, because the risk otherwise is to be a part of something that one might not, in fact, want to be a part of. Independence of mind is important, I think, to try to maintain. Despite, you know, the corrupting influences of the corporate or institutional world one is in. On a larger level, you know, we're now facing a situation with Iran where, once again, the world is trying to basically push a policy whereby sanctions, it is hoped, would stop that country from acquiring weapons of mass destruction. In that sense, it's a rather similar situation to the Iraq one, where we also had an equation, on the one hand, weapons of mass destruction, and on the other hand, sanctions, which risked hurting the actual population more than the regime itself, which basically just goes into the black market and profits exponentially from such policies. So there is a real question, I think, facing the new administration about how to deal with Iran. And during the debates, President-elect Obama basically announced that he would push for sanctions on fuel against Iran. Since they don't have a refining capacity, they actually need to import fuel from the outside. Now... it sounds like tough language, and I think a lot of the hawks are in fact supporting this kind of approach as well. The problem is it won't work. It won't work because it is not enforceable unless you basically impose a naval quarantine on Iran, and even then, there's different ways they can smuggle oil in and out of the country. So we have a real enforcement problem. We have a United Nations Security Council which can adopt such laws if it even gets to that, but cannot enforce them because the neighboring countries simply won't cooperate, and that'll be that, just like it was with Iraq.
Do you have any alternatives to dealing with Iran and its desire to be to have nuclear power?
Well, you know, it's obviously a difficult issue. But to be quite frank with you, I was at a briefing last summer at the Ditchley House in Oxford, where a former very senior member of the British intelligence services, whom I can't name here, came in and briefed us. And in his opinion, Iran's march to the acquisition of nuclear weapons is basically unstoppable unless some kind of military action is taken. And there is no appetite for such action either in Europe or the United States, and possibly even in Israel. We don't. It's hard to say, obviously, but it's a very difficult proposition for a democratic country to launch a surprise attack of the kind we would be talking about in the case of Iran. So, you know, we've been deluding ourselves for many years now into thinking that the negotiations and so on could prevent Iran from acquiring these weapons. The fact is they've said themselves that nothing that we can do will prevent they're continuing sprinting for the nukes, which is what they've done over the past few years. This is a reality we're going to have to start accepting, because there really is no sense in deluding ourselves that sanctions are either going to be adopted by the Security Council. I don't think Russia and China will vote along with them. And even if they were, the experience of Iraq shows that the implementation of such sanctions is really limited.
Yeah. Let me take a short pause, and we will welcome callers. We're talking with Michael Sasson. He's the author of the book Backstabbing for Beginners, My Crash Course in International Diplomacy. It talks about his time with the United Nations and the Oil for Food program scandal. He's the guy who essentially blew the whistle on that. And he writes about that experience in this book. He currently teaches international affairs and the Iraq conflict at New York University Center for Global Affairs. And he's here to talk with you about international diplomacy, the battle against corruption, some of the challenges that the Obama administration faces. We just talked about Iran. Is it next? I want to talk a little bit more about ending the war in Iraq and how that's going to work coming up after this break. 1-800-642-1234. What do you think? What questions do you have? Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you. Kathleen and her guest will remember the life and work of Studs Terkel. The famed writer, broadcaster, oral historian, died last week at 96, and Kathleen Dunn and her guest will remember him coming up in our next hour. We are remembering the Oil for Food program scandal at the United Nations. Our guest was the former UN program coordinator for that program, was someone who helped blow the whistle on the scandal. Michael Sosson is also author of a book about that experience, Backstabbing for Beginners, My Crash Course in International Diplomacy. He's also someone who teaches international affairs at New York University's Center for Global Affairs, and we welcome your questions for him. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You know, I started the program, Michael, with something that you wrote back in, I think it was in 2005, on we owe the people of Iraq an apology. Mm-hmm. Did that ever come?
No, it did not. I believe the UN Security Council should have acknowledged what kind of business it was involved in. The only reason the scam, the enormous multi-billion-dollar scam, could be kept silent for so long was because the party that was being ripped off, mainly the Iraqi people, did not have a voice in the affairs of the United Nations. And, you know, before we heal from a period in history that was extremely divisive, that both divided America and Europe and America within, we have to admit that our actions were not, if we take from 1991 to 2003, our actions were not particularly considerate to the Iraqi people. We, for all these years, basically asked them to pay with their lives for our sense of security. And before we accept our responsibility for this, until we do, we will not be able to properly heal from this conflict. There was no way, in my view, to justify a war in 2003 without coming to the conclusion that deposing Saddam Hussein might have been a good idea. In fact, in 1991, when we had the international community with us, and a war that was mostly paid for by Japan and Germany, in fact, and Saudi Arabia. In 2003, the justifications for going into Iraq were muddy and mixed in weapons of mass destruction, the appearance of an immediate threat, with the idea that we should expand democracy and so on. And while it did convince a majority of Congress and the American people at the time, in the days after 9/11, I really think that we got a bit confused. And once we were in and saw that it would be a long fight, basically the heart wasn't there. The American people were quickly depressed by the turn of the conflict and by how hard it was to, in fact, take a society that we had participated in defrauding and destroying and cannibalizing together with Saddam Hussein for all these years. Mm-hmm. To take such a society and put it on a realistic path to democracy was a lot harder than the Bush administration had anticipated.
Yeah. You know, we have lots of callers now, and running short on time, but I did want to ask you, do you see the war in Iraq ending anytime soon?
Yes, I think, in fact, it has in fact, mostly ended.
Yeah, do you see troops coming home anytime soon?
Yeah, well, even the Bush administration has started giving redeployment orders, and it is surprising how in line the Bush administration and the incoming Obama administration, in fact, are on Iraq at this time. Not that they were a year ago, mm-hmm. and certainly not 2 years ago, but today we're talking about a significant redeployment of American troops, with a significant scaling down of combat operations in Iraq as they hand over that task to the Iraqi security forces. Now, whether we have, in fact, a guarantee of future stability, no. Iraq is going to remain unstable for the foreseeable, and it's going to take many years for democracy to take root there. But the war in Iraq, as we know it, as we knew it in 2004, for example, 2005, 2006, is significantly a conflict that's been significantly reduced. The levels of violence have gone down significantly. And we will continue to hear, you know, explosions day in and day out in various parts of Iraq. But the intensity of the conflict is of a much lower nature than it was a couple of years ago.
June and Shano is with us now. Hi, June. You're on the air.
Hi, Joy. I would like to ask your guest about the rumors of Kofi Annan's son being involved in this. Is this true?
Well, in my opinion, there isn't much to this. Kofi Annan's son, there was a conflict of interest here. He did work for a company that was employed by the UN under the UN under the World Food Program. This company was called Cotecna, and it was responsible for certifying the arrival of goods into Iraq. So there was speculation that that company got the UN contract because Kofi Annan's son worked there. In my opinion, this speculation has not been confirmed by any sort of proven pressure by Kofi Annan to give the contract to that company. It simply hasn't been confirmed by the Volcker Report. There has been some wrongdoing and some conflicts of interest that should have been better handled. But ultimately, Paul Volcker did not find Kofi Annan to have acted illegally or inappropriately on behalf of his son.
All right. Thank you, June, for the call. Chris in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Chris.
Hi. All the years that this was going on, all the American people heard was that money and stuff was getting through to Saddam that shouldn't have. And I'm glad now that I hear that what the real problem was Iraqi people were starving through this, and Iraqi people were dying over this. And really, that was the crime. It wasn't that there was graft and corruption. If there's government, there's graft and corruption. The problem, the criminality was that people died over this. It was just so sad.
Well, in a sense, I agree with you. You see, it was a very incoherent mission, because on the one hand, the UN imposed sanctions on this country, and on the other hand, we had this program using their own oil revenues to come to their aid. So, in essence, we were there to save the Iraqi people from our own policies of sanctions. In Brooklyn, that's called a racket.
Yeah. Oops, she's not there anymore. I have an email from Neil. Was there evidence that Saddam was planning to use the written record of corruption as blackmail information against UN enforcement officials?
Very good question. In the end, he did not himself use it, but the people at Almada, which is the Iraqi newspaper which got hold of the list, did say that it was former Ba'athist officials that gave them this list. Even in the first Gulf War, Saddam had, in fact, in some of his statements, threatened to reveal some of the information he had. It was certainly something that had French and Russian officials feeling very uncomfortable.
Yeah, so did this scandal cast a shadow on all humanitarian efforts undertaken by the UN?
No, I think it enlightens us to the nature of dealing with dictatorial regimes. Even when you're doing humanitarian work, these regimes will profit from it. For once, as we said before, we have this on the record. We were able to establish the scale and the incredible collusion that some of our most venerable international corporations, including many American companies, the extent to which they will go to do business, even under humanitarian programs, and especially, in fact, under humanitarian programs. The levels of corruption are quite often staggering, and it must be understood, almost inevitable. Mostly when we have a humanitarian program, it is because it is in part because the country is under the rule of a dictatorship that causes these humanitarian crises. And so, you know, if there was a humanitarian crisis in Denmark tomorrow, and the UN decided to intervene, then I think we could expect that there would be minimal levels of corruption. But humanitarian, you know, emergencies call for the kind of purchasing and transport rules that favor any dictatorial regime that has control over the means of communication within their country.
Eddie in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, good morning. I have a question regarding the Israeli settlements in the West Bank, the illegal settlements. Mm-hmm. And the United Nations Security Council has been basically powerless in trying to stop these. With the new administration, does you guys think that Barack Obama and the new administration will have the courage to push Israel to stop these illegal settlements, or are we looking to continue the double standards of not really touching that issue because of the power of the Israeli lobby in the United States?
Well, I mean, insofar as the UN is concerned, the Israel has a very poor lobby there. In fact, they are not even admitted to many of the committees, and the Palestinian cause at the UN has been, you know, getting a lot of support both from the Secretary Generals in the past and the institution as such. One of the only states that basically always gets accused of wrongdoing by the Human Rights Commission, which has on its states like Syria and other human rights abusers, is in fact Israel. And so it has a friend in the United States that stands up to that. But as you said, the settlement activity is considered illegal under the Land for Peace Agreement and does constitute a problem. It's been a long-standing problem, including in U.S. relationships with Israel. Obviously, terrorist acts are also considered illegal by the United Nations, and so the equation in the Middle East stays the same. And I think the condition for Obama to do to have an effecting role in promoting peace, we're actually closer to a peace deal than most people realize. The equation stays the same. The condition of Obama playing a constructive role in this is to be able to engage and establish trust with both parties. This traditionally has included the U.S. lobbying for a freeze to the settlements. As you know, Israel has also dismantled a lot of settlements in recent years as it was withdrawing from Gaza, for example. So I don't think the fundamental equation changes, and I don't think it's a question of courage on the part of Obama, courage in standing up to the Israel lobby or such. I think it's a question of trust of the United States, gaining trust of both sides, and being able to help them along on the path that has been the same path for a long time, land for peace. And it's not going to change until a deal is struck in that regard.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts for us on future U.S.-Russian relations with the Russian president saying that he's going to put missiles in Poland over the U.S. Defense Shield plans, and this coming right after Barack Obama is elected?
Well, we're dealing with a war of nerves that has started for a while now under the Bush administration, and Russia, what we call the resurgent Russia today, is no longer a democracy. It is no longer a country that has a free press, and it is a country in which one man, Vladimir Putin, basically holds all the reins of power. Him and his friends in the the Russian version of the military-industrial oil complex. Relations between the United States and Russia will, in large part, depend on the discussions that are being held now about missile defense. Russia, as we know, has considered the deployment of defensive capabilities by NATO as a provocation, and has basically threatened to reignite, to put its old missiles on alert once again. This is, in fact, a very dangerous, slippery slope, and whether the new administration of Barack Obama can defuse this situation remains to be seen. It's very hard to predict at this point.
Yeah. And besides Russia, though, we hear a lot of people around the world and leaders around the world welcoming our new president.
Absolutely.
Do international relations, do you think that they will be improving with Barack Obama in the White House?
Well, we have a new reserve of goodwill. You know, not necessarily with the Iranian regime or with the regime of Vladimir Putin or with Sudan, you know, the Sudanese government. But we have an enormous reserve of goodwill with the people who watched on their televisions the election of Barack Obama. So obviously in Western Europe, this election was welcome by very enthusiastic crowds, both in France and other places. It's fair to say that even the Russian people and the Iranian people are probably affected by this. But the regimes, on the contrary, I think, are wary of seeing America enjoy a new, you know, a more positive public image, and they will do whatever they can in the coming months to throw a monkey wrench in Obama's wheels.
Yeah, in our final minute, is there a positive role for the UN to play in resolving conflicts and humanitarian crises?
Sure. I mean, the United Nations is an imperfect institution, which has been very difficult to reform and may, in fact, be unreformable, because it was designed to allow its members to avoid accountability rather than face accountability. Unlike NATO or the EU, it has no conditions for membership. Anyone can be a member, whether they respect human rights or not. So this is the fundamental dilemma the UN is having to deal with. And there's just no way around the fact that it'll continue to be a problem to have countries like Sudan sitting on human rights commissions, or the government of Rwanda sitting on the Security Council, even as it's committing genocide, as happened in 1994-95. However, there is an incredible reserve of goodwill at the United Nations among its agencies like UNICEF or the World Food Program. Yeah. These agencies save lives every day.
Yeah, and we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking
pleasure.
With us today. Michael Sasson, author of Backstabbing for Beginners. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.